Morning is Nelson versus Ritchie. Mr. Krieger, good morning to you.
Morning. Please report. This is an action on a reviver of a money judgment. The issue is a dispute between Pamela Jensen, who was a judgment creditor, against Hal Ritchie, who is the judgment debtor in the case. Pamela obtained a money judgment against Mr. Ritchie in 1996. That judgment was on a promissory note. Pamela claimed that she entered into an agreement with Hal to waive the formal execution of the judgment process in exchange for his agreement to make regular payments on the judgment until the judgment was satisfied. Simple math put that payment schedule beyond the 10 years that would have been applicable to either enforce or revive that judgment. Hal performed under that agreement, making those payments for over 20 years until February of 2017, when he stopped making those payments.
That agreement was not in writing?
The agreement was not in writing. I don't recall anything in the record suggesting that.
Did the trial court find that there was or was not such an agreement?
I think the best the trial court did is, in its ultimate conclusion, says that Pamela had not met her burden of proof on equitable whatever she was claiming. She hosted a variety of theories to... But there weren't any fact determinations. What I can state is the record is about this big, and the only evidence in the record is the affidavit from Pam Jensen and James Chotter, her attorney at the time, who set forth the agreement and his schedule of payments. The only evidence in the record to support any of this is the two affidavits, Your Honor.
Okay. If this had not been reduced to judgment, Section 25-216 clearly would have extended the statute of limitations with each voluntary payment.
Correct.
Right? But there is no such language
right
in the dormant judgment statute.
So I skip to the end and tell you how I get there.
Right?
Right.
I mean, you can see where I'm coming from.
Well,
here,
I can see both. This is odd for me. I wasn't the trial attorney. I was asked by some lawyers who said, this is a big deal. So we have to, you know, really carefully analyze where the court comes down on this, because it does seem to be a matter of first impression, and with the peculiarities of our state statutes and case rulings, I don't know that any other jurisdiction answers it for us fairly. So the long and the short of it is that despite her claim and evidence to support and the fact that he paid on the judgment for 22 years, well beyond the time period that she could have either sought execution on the judgment or renewed the judgment, which are the things she bargained to not have to do by the agreement, the trial court simply said the 10-year statute of repose, statute of limitations, whatever it is, applied, and it couldn't be waived, it couldn't be ratified, estoppel, all the arguments that she was making below didn't apply, and simply said, you can't do this. Now, she didn't say, or we didn't discuss in the briefs, what else she might do, but at least at this part, you can't use those arguments to extend the 10-year statute of something, right?
Well, what were the arguments that were presented to the district court?
Well, the two basic arguments that we briefed is if it's a statute of limitations, like any other statute of limitations, it's affirmative defense, it has to be raised, or it can be waived by facts. And so her first argument was if it's a statute of limitations, it was waived, right?
Well, most of the analysis in the district court's opinion, as I recall it, focused on whether 25-216 applied to a judgment situation, correct?
Correct.
But I don't see you relying on that as much on appeal. Is that fair?
What's fair is that I don't know what it is. I can say with all candor, there are perfectly valid legal arguments on both sides, that if it's a this, you can't do it. If it's a that, you can. But the question was, the issues below, as I recall them from the short record, is if this is a statute of limitations, like any other statute of limitations, your conduct can waive that. Right? If it's not a statute of limitations, if it's some other repose, then do equitable principles of waiver, estoppel, does this conduct offer her any relief from those theories? So I can't tell you. I can tell you, I guess, that there are fair arguments on both sides, right? And the parties brief them, and the court is familiar with it. You characterize it this way, you have one result. You characterize it another way, you get a different result. So there are complex legal questions behind it, and I'm just going to say that's something you have to decide because it does seem to be a matter of first impression. But
under the approach that you propose, there would be no way for someone else outside a potential future creditor of this judgment debtor to tell from the state of the record whether the judgment was still alive or had become dormant, correct?
That would have been true after 5 years, Judge.
Well,
if
there had been an execution, or perhaps they would agree to a formal execution that would be returned unsatisfied every so years, then a creditor would know, a future creditor would know from the state of the record, this one's still alive.
Right.
But there's no way to tell from this record.
And I don't know what difference it makes to the parties that were parties to the agreement. Maybe some stranger would have a better argument than this, Mr. Ritchie would.
Well, but this is a systemic issue, not just these parties, isn't it?
It works both ways. And I guess in the limited time I have, I guess the answer seems to me to be simplifying the question. The legal analysis will take care of itself. I don't have a better argument than the one I've made. And they don't have a better argument than the one they've made. If it's a this, you can't do it. If it's a that, maybe you can do it. So really what it comes down to for the lawyers that are affected by this, the collection lawyers, the lawyers that have thousands of judgments that have to keep track of these and have to not only do that paper thing where they do the execution, have to tell the sheriff, return it unsatisfied, keep track of that, and if they don't do that, remember when it's 10 years. And for judgment debtors who are sitting there with a big judgment, this is several zeros, you know, they may have the assets if you look, and you may have to pay, or they may inherit something. So the uncertainty, the cost, all the policy reasons for entering into this agreement are to avoid all those things. It's stability for the creditor, it's stability for the judgment debtor, and the law is either getting in the way of what they want to do, that is that they think they can do this only to find out that they can't, or you just enforce the agreement and you find a way for the law to bend or give way to the intentions of the parties. It becomes a bad deal. For any deal within 10 years, it's not a problem. For any deal that they make that satisfies the judgment within the statutory period, if they don't, then it's on the judgment creditor to go in and revive and execute and do all those things. They would have notice of that. But if
there is an agreement and we hold that you can't revive this judgment because it's dormant, could you bring a separate action attempting to enforce the agreement?
I think the appellee talks about whether we're trying to do that in this case. I think my position in my brief was that really isn't before us. Ms. Jensen, you can't do this, but you can enforce your oral agreement in a separate action that we can file and use this as stare decisis to say this is our remedy, yes, but we could get to that separate action only to find that the court says that there's some procedural impediment to that. So we're obligated at least to try to assert it now when it matters and to give my client the benefit of the bargain she thought she had and to not allow the judgment creditor a windfall in all this. I think the balance is still $200,000. He paid $132,000 on the judgment for 22 years. And now, oops, never mind. I found a loophole. And that's the problem. The problem is, I think, the policy issues for these agreements being executed in the first place so that lawyers and judgment creditors can rely on them favors an interpretation that says you can do this. And for those reasons, we think the trial court erred in concluding that it was time-barred, either by the statute of repose, statute of limitations, or in rejecting the notion that we can enforce this agreement by extending those execution times in accordance with the agreement, revive the judgment, and then use the voluntary or the involuntary collection processes that are out there. You know, for all we know, he inherited $1 million and now says you can't collect it, right? So if it's fair, he got the benefit of it for all this time. She relied on it, didn't do anything, and so for a legal proposition to come in and say that was a mistake 22 years later would just be unfair. There may not be any room in a naked, bare legal analysis for fairness and unfairness, but we think if you look at the policy considerations behind what they were trying to do to allow him to assert this defense at this time is just wrong.
Give you one last question before you sit down, since you've already used your rebuttal time. Why isn't this a question for our friends down the hall and not us?
I've heard from collection lawyers that our collection statutes are inartful and somewhat confusing and not all that clear. It may be, and you may have to say, Mr. Krieger, unfortunately for you, the result in this case is harsh, so head to the legislative body. But oftentimes when those statutes don't seem to square with hard facts, we interpret the statutes in a way that brings comedy to all of the various provisions, and I would think there's a way through this in which you just simply conclude that apply the law in accordance with the agreement of the parties and don't allow a technical interpretation to defeat that to the detriment of my client. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Welch, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Dave Welch. I represent the appellee, Hal Ritchie, in this case. My first position in this case is one, this is not a statute of limitations. The statute of reviver, 25-1440, is a statute of reviver. This isn't about a commencement of an action or anything of that nature. And if you read the statute clearly, it says, no judgment shall be revived unless action to revive the same be commenced within 10 years after such judgment become dormant. So my position simply is this is a statute of reviver that cannot be extended by equitable estoppel or a waiver. Okay? Now second, let's just talk about equitable estoppel and waiver. We're talking about this so-called agreement. What is this agreement? What is this oral agreement? You have an affidavit in front of you, Exhibit 100. Exhibit 100 is from the plaintiff in this case. She says, I had an agreement to hold off on execution if he made payments. That's simply what this affidavit says. It doesn't say, it's the most indefinite argument of a contract I've ever seen. It fails on indefinite. Is it in perpetuity? Does it last for 1,000 years? The statute of fraud would say if this is a contract for something for more than 1 year, right? It has to be in writing. So let's just say this is a 1 year deal then. We don't know. It's too indefinite. But if you're going to argue equitable estoppel, Exhibit 100 has in front of you all the payments. No payments were made in the year 2010. Not one. 15 months goes by, he doesn't make a payment. On March 9th, 2011, the plaintiff files an affidavit of garnishment. This is after it's become dormant. This is within the revival time period. Clearly, she knows he hasn't made payments for over a year, and she's going after him. So to say that he made payments to 2017, not true. But she withdraws it 4 or 5 days later. The revival time period does not run until April 8th, 2011. Clearly, she had time to do it. If you're going to find this is a statute of limitations, she didn't rely upon anything. There was no material misrepresentation of fact, no concealment of material facts. She didn't rely upon anything in this regard. And clearly, the facts show, I mean, this is the thinnest transcript and bill of exceptions you guys see in probably a couple of years.
Mr. Welch?
Yes?
Please don't refer to the court as you guys.
You bet, Your Honor. I apologize. But this is a very thin record. And in regards to that, it's not equitable estoppel. And it's not waiver. Waiver would be relinquishing an active legal right, and that's not the case here either.
Is this a correct reflection of your comments? There is no agreement?
Well, there's an agreement. There's no evidence in front of the court. There's not the agreement of hold off in making payments, and I won't execute.
Too many negatives for me.
Sure. But
is there an agreement of some sort, and if so, what are its terms?
The very limited agreement of we won't execute if you're making payments. That's what she has in her affidavit. And that's the only agreement.
And your view of that is that represents an agreement such as the terms no more, no less.
No more, no less. Okay. And it's very indefinite, and there's no terms as far as what the payments are going to be, how long it's going to last. You have to do it with X time period. And you, within 5 years, certainly can file an execution within that or an agreement to extend so the statute doesn't, or the judgment doesn't become dormant. So
is the effect of that agreement, such as it is, or limited though it may be, would you characterize it as a standstill agreement?
What's a standstill agreement?
When you all agree not to go after each other so long as something's happening.
Well, I wouldn't, because obviously it's verbal. It's an understanding more so than anything at that point in time. But certainly by the year 2010, when no payments are being made for 15 months, I think it's pretty clear that no longer is that agreement, if it was in place at the time, is no longer being followed. And certainly at that time, they could file a motion for reviver, which had been very simple at that point in time, and they failed to do so. Based upon that, Your Honor, the district court's ruling of denying the motion to revive should be affirmed by this court.
Is your client getting a windfall here, and does that have any bearing on what this court should do?
It certainly shouldn't, because one, if we're going to go back, if we want to talk about a windfall, we should go back to the fact when the default judgment occurred. That's how the judgment was, and he didn't realize he had been sued. I mean, if we're going to get into arguments like that, my argument would be she got the windfall in this thing because of the situation. Like, these are facts outside of the record, but there's no windfall here, not in the least.
If there was an agreement, and I understand you may contend that it wasn't enforceable or it wasn't sufficiently definite, but if there was an enforceable agreement, is this something that Mr. Krieger's client could institute a separate action and enforce?
I certainly don't believe so. I don't think you can institute a second action in regards to holding off and making payments on a judgment. But if the court thought that was a cause of action and could, certainly the statute of limitations, or excuse me, the statute of frauds would apply, and also a statute of limitations would apply then. And if you're saying in 1996 there was an agreement to make payments, if he files something in that respect, fine, the court will dismiss it, I believe.
Well, the statute wouldn't start running until there was a breach, right?
Sure. Well, then I guess the breach would have been in 2010 when no payments were made for 15 months. The contract is so indefinite. What's a breach? Well, clearly the court would have to think that there was no contract, no written document, so it must just be a one-year
situation. Okay, well, let's take it out of the specific context of this case.
Sure.
Assume there are no problems with the agreement. It's in writing and it says, I won't execute and I'll make and periodic payments will be made. Can a separate action be instituted in that?
I don't believe so. I don't know how somebody can create a cause of action based upon not paying on a judgment. I just don't think there's a proper cause of action for that. But I guess the argument would be it would be a breach of contract. And then if the court believed that there was a contract, as indicated for our purposes on the question, then all rules and on a contract would apply. And first of all, how definite is the contract? I believe it would fail for indefiniteness. Two, when did the breach occur? Certainly the breach occurred in the year 2010. And then certainly a statute of limitations argument would apply.
Or would that be day one? For statute of limitations purposes.
Well, if day one was for the statute of limitations, that would have expired on an oral contract 4 years later, the year 2014.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case of the day is Krejci versus Krejci.